You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In the world of policing, there is no more secretive or despised activity than the work of the Internal Affairs Department, a world of snitches and informants, wiretaps and sting operations. Charles Campisi headed the New York Police Department's Internal Affairs Bureau for 18 years. He led a pioneering program to catch and punish cops who commit crimes and to improve the reputation of the cops who investigate them. His new memoir, Blue on Blue, an insider's story of good cops catching bad cops, is published by Scribner, and I'm very pleased it has brought Charles Campisi to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you so very much for having us here.
Hasn't there always been the problem of corruption ever since the NYPD was created in 1845?
Yes, you're absolutely right. In 1845, the NYPD was born, and it had 800 members. And at that time, to be a member of the New York City Police Department, you had to bribe the local alderman. And depending upon how much of a bribe or what position you wanted, it cost more money to be a sergeant or a roundsman, that they called it back then, or to be a captain. And to get different assignments throughout the city was more money.
And once they became cops, have the crimes that are most commonly committed by police officers, are they pretty much the same or have they changed over time?
Well, it has changed over time because there was other commissions that were formed to investigate police misconduct. Back then, they called them bawdy houses, where officers were being paid to protect, you know, prostitution and a violation of the blue laws, the drinking on Sunday, etc. But it always has been a form of greed, a form of trying to benefit yourself personally.
And I had an uncle who was a vice cop during Prohibition, and although they never found any money, they just assumed that he'd hidden something away.
Well, that was the concept back then, that officers were generally on the take, and it wasn't true, but that was the concept.
Wasn't the original Internal Affairs Office created in response to the Knapp Commission? That's fairly recent, 1972.
Yes, the Internal Affairs Division, as it was called back then, was created because of the Knapp Commission. They wanted a unit, an investigative unit, that would be responsible for investigating misconduct and corruption.
Have things ever gone back to the level of widespread corruption that led to the Knapp Commission?
I'm very happy to say that systemic corruption that was fostered during the time of the Knapp Commission hasn't shown its head again in New York City. But corruption mutates. It evolves. And that's why the investigative agencies that are in charge of looking for it need to change themselves, need to grow and evolve.
When you were growing up in Bushwick, what was that neighborhood like and what were the attitudes toward the local police officers?
Well, in growing up in Bushwick back in the 1950s was a wonderful time. It really was. We were a conglomerate of people. We were a diverse group. We didn't have any money, but we didn't know we were poor. We always did things. We always were friendly with people. And it was different. But the police officers were looked at more respectfully then than they are today.
Despite the fact that a lot of them were probably on the take, and it was assumed that when they went into the local luncheonette that they were going to get their food free. I remember the image of the cop with taking an apple from the fruit stand. That was just understood to be the norm.
Well, back then that was believed to be the norm, that officers were entitled to these little gratuities, these little extras. And people expected it, and it really wasn't in the public's consciousness.
No one in your family was a cop. Why did you want to join the force?
Well, many years ago, I had an aunt who lived next to the 83rd precinct in Brooklyn. And I talked to the police officers as they were coming in and out. I admired them. They were friendly. They treated me well. And I wanted to be like them.
What was your first assignment?
Oh, when I first graduated the police academy, I was part of a scooter task force here in Manhattan. It was called the Manhattan Traffic Area.
Tell us about the time early in your career when you were asked to report to Internal Affairs.
I call it the great Christmas tree caper of 1978. I was working a detail down by the old World Trade Center. And
before it was built?
No, the World Trade Center was there. This was in 1978.
Ah.
And I had come across a taxi cab driver who had a briefcase, and in the briefcase was some important papers and a credit card, and I followed the exact procedures. A couple of weeks later, I get a notice to go see the Internal Affairs because someone had stolen a Christmas tree from a Christmas tree lot. What they had done is, instead of doing their homework, is they pulled everyone in who was working in and around that Christmas tree lot and basically accused us of stealing a Christmas tree. So I didn't think they had done a particularly good job, and I didn't think they had treated me well, especially that all the facts and circumstances pointed that I was nowhere near. So I said to myself, I'll never go work into the Internal Affairs Bureau, and if perchance I ever have to, I'm not going to treat people poorly.
Did they ever crack the great Christmas tree caper of 1978?
Not to my knowledge.
My guest is Charles Campisi, former chief of the NYPD Internal Affairs Bureau, who's written with the help of Gordon Dillo, Blue on Blue, an insider story of good cops catching bad cops. Good cops hate crooked cops, so why don't they want to help Internal Affairs investigate corruption?
A lot of it is the image that Internal Affairs has garnered over the years. If you look at television and movies, the Internal Affairs investigators are usually portrayed as the bad guys who are looking to hurt good cops, looking to prevent cops from doing their job. As a matter of fact, we did a series of focus groups where we asked police officers what was their impression of Internal Affairs. And they basically had three images of Internal Affairs investigators. One was cowards, people who were afraid to be real police officers, so they went and hid in Internal Affairs. The others were rats, probably people who got in trouble themselves and thought that they could buy their way out by ratting on other cops. And then zealots who are going to change the world. Now, those perceptions are probably not true, but they are true to the people who have them.
Wasn't Frank Serpico hated by almost everyone on the force till the day to today? He's I guess he's around 90 years old now.
I had an opportunity to talk to Frank Serpico a couple of years ago. And yes, he was vilified in the police department because he was upsetting the apple cart back then.
What was your reaction, considering what you'd said earlier, when then police commissioner Ray Kelly assigned you to work on the Internal Affairs Bureau in 1993?
Well, I remember the meeting very distinctly. It took 11 minutes to have this meeting. The first 8 minutes were me trying to talk him out of it. And the last 3 minutes of him giving me my assignment and telling me when to report.
Did he give you the budget and personnel you needed to improve the IAB?
I was very fortunate in the time I was there that I worked for police commissioners that were very dedicated to rooting out corruption, giving resources, not only personnel and money and equipment that we needed, but the police commissioner that I've worked for, the police commissioners that I've worked for, have been very, very diligent in fighting corruption.
Don't most cops stay for just 2 years and then rotate back to other assignments?
That's the new system of drafting people or selecting people into Internal Affairs. But it's not 2 years to the day. It's approximately 2 years, and we try to rotate them out. But they're selected because of their talents and abilities. We're selecting people who are very well respected within the police community, good investigators, talented people.
And why do they move back? Because they'd be stigmatized if they continued working for the Bureau?
Well, that's part of the program. The program is to bring them into Internal Affairs. These are talented people. Have them work on some very important cases. And then by putting them back into the police department, back into other investigative units, it shows that Internal Affairs isn't that stigma.
But you have to be sure that the cops you bring into Internal Affairs are not the corrupt cops.
We do a very extensive background check on the people that we're looking to bring into Internal Affairs.
You make a distinction between the grass eaters, the cops who take only minor graft, and the meat eaters, the ones who are always after the big score. What are some of the crimes that the Bureau has had to investigate?
Well, we've done quite a few things. And those terms, grass eaters and meat eaters, goes all the way back to the Knapp Commission, where those were terms that they used.
You can stop for a moment and turn off your phone. It's okay.
I'm sorry.
I'm sure people listening are wondering what's going on there.
We're going to just shut this right off.
There's been gun running. There are suspects have been brutalized. They're stealing from drug dealers and crime victims. They're selling heroin and cocaine. The sorts of things that the cops are supposed to be going after instead of engaging in.
Unfortunately, you're absolutely right. We've had cases where, and again, to get back to grass eaters and meat eaters, that's a term, again, that came out of the Knapp Commission. And the grass eaters were people who would accept a free meal, the portrait you spoke about of taking a free apple. And the meat eaters were people who were actually out there looking to benefit themselves, looking to be corrupt.
And so this is an opportunity to make big scores.
Yes, usually.
So they're really criminal types who've joined the force? Or do you think that they start off with good intentions and become corrupted? Often we've heard, at least in movies like Serpico, that there was an environment that a cop would discover himself to be in, and he either joined in or was considered an outsider, an outlier.
It's both. It's actually both. You had the people who start off to be good cops, and they take that slippery slope. You don't find too many of them, but that is a reality. Many times, these are people who got by our screening system, perhaps people we shouldn't have hired in the first place, that came in, and they were looking for a way to benefit themselves.
I was wondering in reading this book why there wasn't an anonymous tip line for police to report corruption before you set one up.
Well, there always was a system where they could report corruption, but it wasn't anonymous. You had to identify yourself, and most officers are very reluctant to do that.
Especially because there's this thing called the blue wall of silence.
I'm glad you brought that up because, truthfully, there is a blue wall of silence. But the truth of the matter is, it's not something that's just in the policing profession. That's an occupational wall of silence, and we see it in the medical profession, in the legal profession. On Wall Street. It's this organizational camaraderie where people who depend on each other will tend to look the other way. So is there a blue wall of silence? Yes, but it's not just in policing.
But that's also because even though you may be horrified by what your fellow officer is doing, you also don't want to be vilified for turning him in.
Right. And that's why what we did by setting up this anonymous line is it allows people to just give us the information.
And how many leads did you get as a result of that?
Well, not as many as I would like, but I can tell you each year as we publicize this, the number of tips, if you would, that were coming in were growing each year.
My guest is Charles Campisi, who was chief of the NYPD's Internal Affairs Bureau, the world's largest police anti-corruption unit, for 18 years. He has written a book with the help of Gordon Dillo called Blue on Blue, an insider's story of good cops catching bad cops. It is published by Scribner's, and we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Charles Campisi, the former chief of the New York Police Department's Internal Affairs Bureau. He's written a memoir about his experiences called Blue on Blue, an insider story of good cops catching bad cops. It's published by Scribner's. You receive thousands of calls and emails every year from citizens with complaints about the police. How many of them led to IAB investigations?
I would say we opened up about 1,000 cases a year. And we were able to substantiate about 15 to 20% of them.
And I'm assuming some of them came from angry ex-wives, but also people who had been recently arrested and felt that they'd been treated unfairly or shouldn't have been arrested.
Well, we took every complaint seriously, no matter where it came from. Even if it came from people who were criminals and involved in criminal behavior, because the facts didn't change because of who they were.
What are the challenges of investigating a police officer?
Well, they're greater than most other investigations in that police officers themselves are very knowledgeable about the system. They understand police work and they understand our investigative methods. And they're intelligent people to start with.
And they know what you're looking for.
They know exactly what we're looking for, and they think they can find ways to beat the system.
Are there any consistent indicators as to whether a cop might be guilty?
Well, not if they were, not necessarily if they're going to be guilty or not, but it's a case on facts.
Well, for example, how do you put a tail on a cop who has had training in surveillance techniques?
Very, very difficult to do, but you have to be meticulous. And you have to surveil someone, maybe using multiple cars, maybe moving cars in and out, keeping them off balance as best you can.
I'd imagine that you couldn't just give somebody a wallet with money and see if he turned it in.
Well, those all,
I say he, it's he or she.
Or she.
Do the corrupt cops tend more to be male than female?
Well, I guess more of our complaints are against male officers than female officers. And that wallet test, that would never work in New York City. They're just too savvy to it. If any officer is handed anything of value, they look at you twice and they know that they have to follow the rules.
Don't many of your potential witnesses have credibility problems of their own? It's hard to take the word of a drug dealer or a junkie, a gang member, against the word of a police officer.
Yes, it is. So that's why our investigations have to be comprehensive. We take the information, we understand where it comes from, and we try to do as much as we can proactively to run integrity tests, run sting operations, to get as much evidence as we can that we're not relying solely upon the testimony of someone whose credibility may be in question.
What might be a typical sting operation?
Well, the sting operations...
Other than giving him the wallet, that is not going to work.
Well, we've ran quite a few of them, and I always tell my people that an integrity test, as we call it, is limited by your imagination. So we've done a number of integrity tests where we rented apartments, we rented vehicles. We even did an integrity test where we rented a boat, and we had a call for the harbor police to come in because we had some engine trouble, and we had things of value in the boat. To see if they were going to perform their jobs properly.
Other tests involve even more elaborate scenarios where you rely on undercover operatives. Why are they called uncles?
That's an old term that goes back to the narcotics division. It's just UC, undercover, so they call them an uncle.
Uh-huh. And how do you select cops to become undercovers?
That's an even more difficult thing. You need someone with the right mindset, the person who is able to think well on their feet, the person who can fit into any situation and play a role.
So they're playing a role. Are they ever trained by professional actors?
Well, we did once. We had a professional actor who was helping us with our role playing, helping us with our interactions. And before we would do a sting, we would rehearse it several times so that the officer, him or herself, our undercover, our uncle, would become very comfortable in the role.
I'd imagine it's a bit dangerous because the person that they're investigating has a weapon.
It is very dangerous, and it could be. And that's why we use ghosts. We use people who shadow our undercovers. We try to watch as much as we can with the videotaping everything and watch it in real time. And we do our very best to protect our undercovers.
I'm assuming you look for people who don't look like cops.
Most of our undercovers will never be mistaken for a police officer. They just don't fit the mold.
Do you only perform integrity tests on cops who are suspected of wrongdoing, or do you perform random tests as well?
Yes, we did two types of tests. The targets, which are simple, we believe an officer or a group of officers are involved in some misconduct, and we set up a test to look just like it. But we also do tests all around the city.
And I hear that the police union does not like these tests. Why?
Well, no one likes to be investigated. No one likes to be tested. No one likes to be questioned. But if you look at the manufacturers around the world, every once in a while, they take their product off the shelf and they run it through a series of tests. And we're doing the same thing.
Once they're caught, how do cops try to justify their behavior?
Well, sometimes they just deny it. Sometimes they try to explain that it's factors beyond their control that forced them into it. They use every excuse that any other criminal might use.
When we hear about an accused cop, usually we're told he or she has been moved to a desk job. Do they ever lose their jobs as a result?
Oh, yes. If someone is arrested and convicted, they automatically lose their job. Under New York State law, if you're convicted of a felony or a misdemeanor relative to your performance of duty, you automatically vacate your position.
You also write here about people who impersonate police officers. Is that easy to do?
Unfortunately, it's too easy to do, especially in some of our immigrant communities where perhaps they're used to police officers being corrupt. And it's very easy to get equipment. You can go online and get badges that look like police badges. You can get police uniforms. And unfortunately, they commit very serious crimes, and the police are left with the blame.
What kinds of crimes are we talking about?
Rapes and robberies, home invasions, carjackings.
Why is it the IAB's responsibility to investigate if a cop impersonator commits a crime?
Because up until mostly the very end, we don't know if it's a real cop or not.
So you have to find out first whether a cop actually committed the rape or the robbery. Shook down the store owner or whatever, or whether it was a cop impersonator.
Right. We have to conduct a full investigation. And unfortunately, we had a case where there was a police officer involved who was providing not only equipment and uniforms, but information to these impersonators to let them know where drug dealers were keeping their money in their stash.
Tell us about Group 51.
That's the police impersonation unit.
They actually are the ones who try to figure out whether it was an impersonator or not?
That's correct.
There was a cop impersonator who robbed a pay-o-matic check cashing store in Queens, and they were not inspired by cops as much as by a Ben Affleck movie?
Yes, that is true. What they did is they followed the script in the movie fairly closely, even purchasing Hollywood-type masks that not only hid their identity, but they were African-American men who, with the masks and the gloves and everything else, appeared to be Caucasian.
So how can an average person differentiate between when he's dealing with a real police officer or an impersonator?
Well, if they're dealing with someone who's not in a complete police uniform, we advise them to ask for uniform officers to come to the scene.
In other words, somebody says, I'm a detective. You say, I want a uniform officer as well?
If you have a question, if you don't believe that they might be real or not, yes, you want to see a uniformed officer respond.
My guest is Charles Campisi, who is a former chief of the New York Police Department's Internal Affairs Bureau. He's written, with the help of Gordon Dillo, Blue on Blue, an insider story of good cops catching bad cops. It's published by Scribner. This is WMYC, WMYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You had some major scandals that you had to deal with while you were there. What was your initial reaction when you heard that the Haitian immigrant Abner Louima had been sodomized at a police precinct bathroom in 1997?
Well, first it was horror that something like that could happen. And there was a little bit of disbelief. Could another human being do that to a man? Could a police officer do that to a man? And could it have occurred in a police precinct? Our investigation was very comprehensive. Within a short period of time, we had acquired indictments and arrests. And it's a case where the blue wall of silence that we talked about earlier crumbled. Because once other police officers came to realize that this horrific event occurred, they came forward and they provided the information that got us to the conclusions very quickly.
And this is not unique to New York. Just recently, there was a story about something like this happening in Paris, and the investigators said it was an accident. It's really hard to call something like this an accident.
I don't see how that could be an accident. What happened to Mr. Louima, and again, not being in Paris to do the investigation, it appears that these are horrific acts.
Didn't the press try to take credit for breaking that story?
Yes. See, that's one of the problems with internal affairs work. Our work by nature has to be very secretive because we don't want to give away the fact that we're conducting these investigations. So it occurred on a Saturday evening, and our investigation was off and running on Sunday. It doesn't make the press until Wednesday. And naturally, the press, rightfully so, is asking questions. Where is internal affairs? And we can't come forward and say, we've been on this case for 4 days, and here's where we are to date.
These things also become political. This is how you wound up meeting Mayor Giuliani?
Well, this was such a horrific event that we had to brief the mayor on the facts and circumstances of the case.
What was the outcome of the trial of the police officer?
Well, the police officer who actually sodomized Mr. Louima is currently serving a 30-year sentence in federal prison.
Because other cops came forward to testify against Justin Volpe?
Those other cops gave us enough to to make sure that we had a solid conviction.
Another something that you had to deal with, of course, is that people are sometimes shot and killed by police. Sometimes they are not armed. And you had one of the more prominent cases was the Amadou Diallo case.
Yes, and that was a very, very difficult case. And, you know, my book is full of these cases, real cases, to illustrate the points we're trying to make. Now, Mr. Diallo, by all accounts, is an innocent man. He happens to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. There's a series of errors that take place. When the police try to stop him, he runs into his hallway. He's looking to get into his house. He goes into his back pocket and pulls out his wallet. One of the officers mistook it for a gun. 41 shots later, by four officers, an innocent man is dead.
And people wondered why it required 41 shots. Maybe one to his leg might have been enough.
Well, see, that's another thing where the media, television and the movies creates unrealistic scenarios. We're all used to the old TV westerns where the good guys shoot the guns out of the bad guys' hands. That's nearly impossible. The best trained officer under those very stressful conditions very rarely can that happen.
But when you wind up with a situation where Bruce Springsteen is writing a song about something like this, do cops feel under attack?
Oh, of course they feel under attack, because most cops would say, "There for the grace of God go I." I could have been put in that scenario where I was, in my mind, I believed I was in danger and I fired my weapon, and it turns out it's an innocent man.
You express sympathy for those police officers, but I'm sure you understand why a lot of people don't share that feeling.
Oh, absolutely. But I feel more sympathy and more empathy for Mr. Diallo's family. To lose a loved one, an innocent man, is heart-wrenching. And we, you know, those lives have changed forever.
The four cops in the Diallo case were indicted in the Bronx, but the trial was moved to Albany.
Yes, the union was very instrumental in getting it moved out of the Bronx.
And then they wound up being assigned to modified duty?
Well, that's a standard procedure. Whenever an officer fires his or her weapon and we have an injury, the officers are taken off patrol, their weapons are taken from them, and they're put on modified assignment, as we call it, administrative duties.
How did you become aware of Jose Ramos, a cop who was suspected of selling marijuana? And he also owned a barbershop in the Bronx. Is that typical?
Well, it's not typical, but a lot of officers moonlight to try to supplement their income.
Well, what are they paid?
Well, police officers, if all the commissions we talked about, Knapp Commission, Marlin Commission, one of the things they've all said is that pay a police officer a livable wage. Give him or her an opportunity to support their family. And that's one of the only recommendations that's never followed.
Mm-hmm.
They're not paid enough, I can tell you that. But with Mr. Ramos, we got a tip that he was selling counterfeit DVDs and that there was marijuana being sold out of his two barbershops. He owned two barbershops in the Bronx. And we conducted a major investigation, including putting an undercover officer as a barber. He was a licensed barber before we drafted him into internal
affairs. And he spoke Spanish, and that was important,
too. It was very helpful. And we put him into that barbershop so that he would be our eyes and ears right on the scene.
How did you become aware of a number of cops who were fixing traffic and parking tickets for friends and family members? Is that a widespread problem?
Well, I think it was a widespread problem during our investigation in the Bronx. And we came across that investigating, you know, Jose Ramos. We were looking at him for selling marijuana, and we did a number of integrity tests where he transported drugs for what he believed to be a drug dealer, actually my undercover, and he stole money from my undercovers, believing that they were real drug dealers. And on a wiretap, we overheard him fixing a traffic ticket. So our belief at the time was we were just going to add extra charges. And on the wiretap, that investigation kept growing, and more officers became involved in fixing the tickets.
And were you disappointed when the Patrolmen's Benevolent Association, the police union, tried to protect their cops by arguing that fixing a ticket was a courtesy, not a crime?
Oh, absolutely, because it's not a courtesy what they were doing. It's a courtesy if a police officer stops an individual and decides not to give him or her a traffic ticket. They have that discretion. But when they're changing numbers on parking tickets, when they're ripping up accusatory instruments, when they're going to court and perjuring themselves, that's not a courtesy any longer. That's a crime.
Mayor Bloomberg also appeared to be downplaying that crime.
Well, the mayor had his own idea of that until he got the magnitude of what we were investigating.
You served under four different commissioners and four different mayors?
18
years, the longest anyone's ever had that job?
Yes, that's true.
Did you feel at times like, what am I doing here?
Well, I knew that after my two-year commitment, it was up in 1995, and they wouldn't let me leave, that I was going to be here for the long term.
Why did you decide to retire in 2014?
Well, as you're approaching 63 years of age, you have to retire from the police department. It's mandatory. Also, at that time, a new police commissioner came in. They were making a lot of changes.
That was Bill Brennan.
Yes. And I didn't want to move to another bureau for a very short period of time.
Your book could be the basis for a great TV series. How about Law and Order Internal Affairs?
I like that idea. We should discuss that further.
Because, as you said at the beginning, internal affairs is often not depicted in a good light. But it seems to me that this is really something that could be seen as a positive aspect of policing.
I absolutely believe that. And in the book, each chapter is themed on a different element of our investigation, and each chapter has stories in it. And naturally, some of the best stories are in the book, but there are many more stories to be told.
You're a bit critical of Mayor de Blasio, but how do you account for the fact that murders went down over the last couple of years?
I can account for it very easily. The good, hard work of most of the police officers in New York. I know a lot of people like to take credit. You know, a success has many, many parents. And success is great, but success belongs to the police officers who are out there working day in and day out.
Even though they're not doing stop and frisk anymore.
Well, stop and frisk was a very important tool that was being used. Some of the things that we're doing now are just as beneficial.
Charles Campisi was the chief of the New York Police Department's Internal Affairs Bureau. He has written, with the help of Gordon Dillo, Blue on Blue, an insider story of good cops catching bad cops. It is published by Scribner. Thank you so much for being on our show.
It was my pleasure, I assure you.